This is Scott Myers from Deer Valley's Royal Street Cafe, and we are delighted to support KPCW. Located in the Silver Lake Lodge, Royal Street Cafe features new American cuisine and is open daily with sit-down service for lunch, après-ski, and dinner. From 11:30 a.m. to 8 p.m., cocktails, beer, and wine are available. For reservations, 645-6724 or deervalley.com.
Back to Sundance in the morning, and my goodness, we're into the second hour already. Unbelievable. But that time flies when you're working with your co-host, David Darcy from Screen International. Hey there.
I love that. I love the way you repurposed that line. But yeah, time is flying. We found some, two important subjects to talk about. One is the films themselves, and the other is how are these films going to get to an audience, which I think is something that every filmmaker, particularly young filmmaker, should be aware of.
Yeah. Well, at this point, Greg Whitley, director of MIT, this is already going on Netflix. Is that right?
Yeah. We about 4 or 5 months ago agreed to terms with Netflix, and then together we hatched this idea and wouldn't it be great if we got into Sundance? And if we did, let's premiere it while the festival is going on. And the logic being, of course, you get all – a film this size gets the apex of its buzz during a festival like Sundance. And usually the first film I did, we waited 10 months to actually have that film come out and premiere in theaters. And everybody's forgotten about it by then.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is really a common problem. But let's – before we talk about the release of this film – let's talk about the genesis of it, because watching it, we're seeing a relationship between the filmmaker and the Romney family that on the screen is starting in 2006. Presumably the film project started before that. How did this start, and how did you convince Mitt Romney? I mean, here's a guy who was eventually done in by a filmmaker who was filming him at a fundraiser. How did you convince Mitt Romney that making a film, since independent filmmakers tend to be on the left, and probably most of them who voted didn't vote for Mitt Romney, how'd you convince him to participate?
My first film was a film called New York Doll, and it premiered here at Sundance, got distribution. Like I mentioned, 10 months later, it was in movie theaters. So it received a modest art house release. It played about 15 cities across the United States. Boston was one of those. And I would get these reports the following Monday from the distributor. That was a spreadsheet of how much money did we make? How many people came to see the movie in, say, New York or Miami or, in this case, Boston? And I looked at Boston's gate receipts. It was playing one theater in Harvard Square, and I did the math based on the gross receipts, and there must have been 6 people in attendance per screening. And this guy emailed me later that day saying it was one of the 6 people. He said, "Hey, I saw your movie. I loved it. I looked you up on the web, and I just wanted to let you know that the governor of Massachusetts was sitting 2 rows in front of me." So there's 6 people in attendance, and Mitt Romney is one of those people.
But it was a music documentary with an LDS connection.
Yeah. What it was was a punk rocker. It was a guy that was part of a proto-punk rock band in the early 70s called the New York Dolls. He kind of disappeared for 28 years and resurfaced as he had joined the Mormon Church and was working in the genealogical center in near the Los Angeles Mormon Temple.
Arthur Killer Kane.
Great memory. Right?
Yeah.
Yes, Arthur Kane. So that was – our first film was about him. Mitt saw that and apparently liked it from what I heard. And I just started paying attention to him as a result of that. I just thought that was so interesting that the governor of Massachusetts would go see this movie about a cross-dressing punk rocker. And his name began to be mentioned as a possible presidential candidate, and I was just finishing my second film. A producer came to me and said, "Well, what are you interested in doing next?" And I go, there's this guy who's a Mormon governor out of Massachusetts, and he's thinking about running for president. If he does, I think I want to make a movie about that. And this guy just happened to say, "Well, I know someone who knows his son." And he arranged a lunch with Tag Romney, who was working for the Dodgers at the time. We ate at this little sushi restaurant next to Chavez Ravine, and I just pitched him on this movie I wanted to make about his dad, if his dad ran. And Tag said, "Well, I think that's great. Let's do it." Mitt initially said no, but Ann Romney said yes. That eventually led me right up here to Park City, where the family was gathering to discuss whether or not they would run for president. He had a place in Deer Valley. The whole family gathered, And I was allowed to film it, and I just kept filming for 6 years.
And at the time when you were filming in 2006, you thought this might just be about one presidential campaign cycle.
Yeah. Oh, I was convinced. One, when I started filming, it was Christmas Eve. I thought it would just last that night. They gave me no indication that they had any interest in making a documentary film. I just pitched them, just how about just let me film this conversation, and it'll just be my gift to you. Who knows where it goes? Who knows if you'll even end up running for president? And I thought in my head, optimistically, if I'm allowed to film, I've got to somehow find money to keep me afloat for 2 years. I mean, this certainly can't last for longer than 2 years, but it lasted for six.
So why did you make a film about what happened in 2008?
Why did I make
it? Why didn't you? Why didn't you say, well, this guy tried, didn't get the nomination. There was a lot of talk about let's say, elements of his personality that accounted for him not getting the nomination then. That was a story. I mean, a lot of journalists wrote that story. Why did the film end up being made? Why did you choose not to make the film then?
Well, I did. I made a film. My arrangement with Mitt Romney was, look, just if you're going to give me this access, I will agree not to release this footage until you are either finished being president or you're finished running for president. I won't release it. In 2008, he told me he was done. And I was with him the night that he was writing his concession speech. I traveled with him to this CPAC gathering where he announced he was getting out. And I thought, well, that's it. So I went home and edited my film, or started to. And Tech called me and said, whoa, wait a minute. He might be running again. And so I didn't know what to do with that. I guess as his interest in actually running again took real shape, I thought, I have no choice. Let's just keep filming.
Yeah. Was there unanimity in the Romney family about going ahead with this kind of scrutiny from you? I mean, it's not as if you were, you were trying to undermine something, but the camera's there. The camera seems to be there at a lot of intimate moments when they're discussing their own uncertainty about all sorts of things in the campaign.
The campaign itself, the staff and the advisors, did not want me there. But the family appeared to be fairly united and know you should be here. I think over the course of the first 3 or 4 or 5 months that I was shooting, I was focusing almost exclusively on the family because the campaign staff didn't want me around. It was sort of the inverse of the War Room or that Obama movie that came out where you really had only access to the staff and not the candidate. My problem was the reverse. But in doing that, I think the family just became comfortable with me, and as best as I could tell, were all on board with allowing me to film.
Do you think the staff had the feeling that David was earlier talking about, that a documentary filmmaker must be a left winger? He's going to be out to knife him in the back.
Well, I don't think my politics ever came into question. I think they were largely concerned about two things. One, I'm getting very candid footage that even if I'm not somebody that has an agenda to try and bring down this candidate, I could maybe leave a hard drive on an airplane, or somebody could sneak into in my loft and swipe it and make hay with it. Or they were also concerned with just my mere presence of filming is a nuisance. It's a bother. It's distracting. And we've got this important job to do of trying to elect this guy. And so, for a multitude of reasons, I completely understand they did not want me around.
So Bill Clinton, and I'll quote the part that we can say on the radio. Bill Clinton did say about Mitt Romney that he's a guy who really should think about whether politics is the line of work that's his, that's really suited to him. Now, Romney was extremely successful as a leader and as a corporate leader in the private sector. He was successful as governor of Massachusetts. In fact, some of the things he was most successful at were things he repudiated as he moved to become the nominee of the Republican Party. Is Romney – now, and he keeps coming back. Is he – and as you said, after 2008, he said, I'm through. Then he comes back, gets the nomination. People thought he was the most credible person. What we've witnessed now in New York and New Jersey is that the person we thought would be the most credible person for the nomination of the Republican Party, i.e. Chris Christie, has found that, to use a culinary metaphor, his goose is cooked. Could we see Mitt Romney coming back again? Is that possible?
I was shocked he ran the second time, so maybe you shouldn't listen to anything I'm saying, but I would be shocked if he ran again.
Was there, back to the campaign, just for our listeners, was there a real division between the family and the campaign staff? And in some way, did that account for, you know, what happened, the campaign not being as successful as it could have been toward the, in you know, the last couple of weeks?
I didn't see that, but admittedly, I was not privy to inner working the strategy meetings. I mean, really, if you see this film, I've got some strategy meetings on film, but it's really intimate moments of the family, fly on the wall. What is it like to be a candidate from a personal side running for president? Even given that access, there are all kinds of strains. There are all kinds of you can go and read the account of just Game Change and then the sequel to it. Even in Barack Obama, a successful campaign, there's tension between the family and the campaign staff. I didn't notice an unusual amount of strife in the case of the Romney campaign and the Romney family. So if it was there, that would have to come from someone else.
Were there any moments, certain moments where either from the staff or the family that they'd say, boy, Greg, I wish you weren't around now, but we did make a deal with you and,
No Romney ever told me no. And that was my personal rule that the campaign could tell me no all they wanted. But until a person named Romney said, you've got to leave, I wasn't going to stop filming. And they just never did.
What about Mitt Romney did you get from this that you think really has been neglected or misrepresented in the media? The notion that the media misrepresents things, which is not held only by the Romney family, comes out quite a bit in the conversations in this film. What about Romney do you know or did you learn that you think the media either didn't learn or never really represented in a proper way?
Well, I think that there is, in general, a really strange way that we go about electing people. And we put them now through this extended process of vetting. And part of that vetting process, especially if you reach a certain stature as a candidate, is you're assigned a literal army of reporters who travel with you to attempt to do this public good of uncovering just who is this candidate. And in spite of that, I've just noticed in the case of Mitt Romney, he's the only presidential candidate that I ever got to know personally, there is this enormous disparity between who he actually really is and how he's perceived publicly. I have to believe that's true probably across the board.
Well, Al Gore, that we ran into that with Gore. John McCain did a pretty good job of representing his personality and being, you know, the person who he was.
I think it's incredibly difficult under those circumstances to be who you really are.
Yeah.
I think there is so much blame to go around for that disparity. It's not all the candidate. It's not all the campaign. It's not all the press's fault.
Yeah.
We all work in unison to create this disparity.
Yeah, who's going to want to watch a film about Mitt Romney now that he is gone from politics and, you know, we're moving ahead, focusing on the future in politics, and people might view this as old news?
Diane Sawyer said this on election night. She goes, what is the family thinking right now? She's saying this on air. What is the family thinking right now as these election results are coming in? And I'm there. And this film answers that question.
Okay. And the next chance to see the answer to that question, Greg, you've got another showing at the Mark later on, late afternoon today.
We premiere in Park City tonight.
All right. And also Monday at 12:30 at the Redstone. You're going over to Sundance on Wednesday. And then in the Park City area, last one is a week from today, Saturday, 8:30 p.m. at the Prospector.
Yeah.
And so glad to bring you full circle with the film back to Park City. Greg Whiteley, director of MIT.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
This is Larry Warren.
And I'm Doug Wells, inviting you to listen Monday mornings at 9 after NPR News to Mountain Money, KPCW's show about making money, spending money, and investing it wisely.
You'll hear from local entrepreneurs and national figures, anyone with a good story to tell about how to survive and thrive in the marketplace.
Mountain Money. We'll keep it simple and useful every Monday at 9.
Brought to you by Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, and Iron Mountain Group.
The Local View is on the air each weekday, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on KPCW, featuring national news from NPR, international headlines with the BBC, and plenty of local news from our award-winning news department. Interviews, music, your phone calls, lost and found, public service announcements, and I'll be your host. This is Randy Barton, sponsored by CNS Creative Services, Ramp Sports, Mercer Automotive, and Molly Bloom's Gastro Pub.
In the morning with my co-host David Darcy, and coming up, the director of, you know, I think with that exaggeration, probably, you know, in one of the more anticipated films of the festival called To Be Take, and Take is that the right way to say it?
That's the correct pronunciation. Yes,
and I know because. That's how Bender the Robot said it on Futurama, so I know that's got to be right. So tell us a little bit about, well, you know, we know George Takei, at least some part of it, but it turns out to be a person with kind of a surprising number of phases in his life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a documentary portrait about the actor and activist George Takei. And he's, of course, most known for his role in Star Trek, the original Star Trek series, as Mr. Sulu. But beyond that, he was imprisoned in a Japanese-American internment camp in his childhood, which is really an unusual experience to have. And then went on to be a trailblazing Asian-American actor. And most recently came out in 2005. After having been publicly closeted for most of his career and has become a trailblazing activist for LGBT civil rights and goes around educating people about civil rights. And his career has been reignited also by his being the official announcer on the Howard Stern Show, which is really from A to Z.
Yeah, I have to say that if you're expecting a kind of earnest, reverential Sundance-style tribute, the film opens with Howard Stern. So there is a lot of humor here from all sorts of people, also but also from George and George Takei and from his partner. How did this project happen? How did it start?
You know, I didn't know them. I didn't know George and his husband, Brad. After 2005, I had always been a huge Star Trek fan. And I was really thrilled and delighted when George Takei came out in 2005 and became an LGBT activist. And I just started hearing him, like, on radio shows. And he sort of became a spokesperson for that movement. And I thought his attitude and style was just very quick-witted and eloquent, and he could be quite serious or he could be outrageous, and I really resonated with that. And then I read his autobiography, which was about his internment experience as a child, and I just couldn't believe Mr. Sulu had been imprisoned in an internment camp. And so I just thought, there really should be a documentary about this, and I'd love to see it, and I just decided I had to try to approach them and ask, and I was somehow they agreed, and they saw my previous work and liked it. And
tell us a little just a background. What is your previous work?
I made a film called It Came from Kuchar, which is about the legendary underground filmmaking twins George and Mike Kuchar. They were in the Andy Warhol scene of the 60s, but a little funnier than Andy Warhol, and influenced John Waters, Buck Henry, Adam Egoyan, a lot of big filmmakers and directors, despite their, you know, underground work and taste, I would say.
Well, I mean, just to kind of start it at the beginning, and without giving away too much of what's in the movie, tell us a little about where George grew up and what happened to him during World War II. Where, mm-hmm. What camp did he end up in? That was a period where I think even in they had a camp in Utah in the West Desert, I believe.
George didn't end up in Utah, but I believe that you're correct about that. So George was 4 when they were rounded up, and then they were held in camps. While the camps were being built, they were actually held in like a horse stall in Los Angeles for a couple of months. And then he was born in Los Angeles, American citizen. And him and his family were initially sent to Roar, Arkansas, which is the camp that's farthest east. So they went all the way from Los Angeles to Arkansas. And then they had a loyalty questionnaire after a year or so in the camp, which was really about being able to draft people. And his parents refused to sign their loyalty because it was a very offensive, document. And so then they were sent to a high security camp called Tule Lake in Northern California. So they were shipped all the way into Arkansas and then all the way back to California, Tule Lake. And that was the high security camp. They had martial law at times. That was a less pleasant place to be. So he spent the duration of World War II there.
Now, when you see the film, you'll see archival material from George Takei's early life, from the internment experience through George's early days in the entertainment business, then lots of clips from films, from Star Trek, the TV show, Star Trek, the movies. Having made one film, I know that archival material costs a fortune to use, or can cost a fortune to use. How do you afford this? Because there's just a wealth of material. This is not just a Talking Heads documentary.
Right. Yeah, archival footage can be very expensive. So there's a variety of ways to work with archival footage, and one way is it can be licensed. Another way is to go under the fair use rules. So we've done a combination, which is pretty much what documentaries are doing these days, and people specialize in it, and you get insurance, and it's completely legal, but it's the fair use because you're educating people about a subject.
Does the fact that you do go to fair use to use this material, does it discourage distributors who might worry about challenges to rights, down the line?
That's not my understanding and hasn't been my experience, because it, as I said, it's a law that you can do that, and you can still get insurance, and we have insurance, so it's you just have to follow the rules of fair use. You can't just take any footage and put it in your movie and change it. It has to be specified to certain parameters for fair use laws.
Okay, now George, as I understand it, reading Deseret News and other newspapers, which I read, George has come out publicly and in support of gay marriage in Utah. Now, we're at an opportune moment. I don't want to use the cliche, the perfect storm here, but this must be a great time to bring this film to an audience in Utah and to a place where all the media is watching the gay marriage debate and at the same time this fairly significant chunk of the festival that deals with LGBT issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it. What a surprising coincidence. I'm so glad that George will be here to give hope to the people of Utah, because I know a lot of them are hoping that marriage equality will become the law of the land here. And yeah, it's just strange. So if it had to happen, I think it's great that it's happening now, because George will give us hope. But I'm sorry that it is happening at all, that people are being, anyone would be denied the right to marry.
And with a documentary here on Prop 8, mm-hmm. and maybe some other films relating to that also. So there, as David said, it's kind of a harmonic convergence here.
Mm-hmm. And of course, George is here with his husband, Brad, too. So they're here to stand together, and that's a big part of the film is their relationship and how they've endured so many years closeted and now out as sort of a poster couple.
Well, there's plenty of humor in that. Why briefly, when and why did George Takei come out?
He came out in 2005, and in California it was the result of the state legislature had passed the marriage equality, I'm not sure what the specific name is, but a marriage equality law that all Schwarzenegger, who was our governor at the time, had to do was sign it, and it would have been the law of the land. And he decided to veto it, and people were protesting, and George decided, I need to be included in that protest. I need to put my voice out there. So he decided to come out at that time, and that was prior to Prop 8.
Now, from a political legal point of view, just from your perspective, to me, it just seems like this thing is not going to get hashed out finally until it goes to the Supreme Court.
Right. We've had it at the Supreme Court one time, and it went pretty well. But obviously, there's still a lot of work to do, because I remember people were so excited with those rulings, which were great. But, you know, it's important to remember, you know, that was a great victory, but there's still more work, and that may be the case.
Yeah.
That it has to go back. And
Go back a little bit to George's early days as an actor, I guess, would maybe starting in kind of the late 50s or something. And what was it like trying to become an actor and a new face as an Asian American when, if you look at, you know, old movies and TV, all the actors who played Orientals, they could meet in this room, mm-hmm. right?
And they'd have to use a kind of central casting accent and play characters who were kind of foolish. What's turned around now?
Well, I think it's changed quite a bit, but of course George faced tremendous obstacles. It was nearly impossible. So, you know, it's easier now, but I don't think it's super easy still for Asian American, especially men. I'm not 100% sure about that, but to break through.
But the breakthrough for the film to be Takei, your first screening, Jennifer, is today, actually.
To be Takei today.
and today is Saturday, 9 p.m. at the Yarrow, the hotel behind the Holiday Village. Then you're down to Salt Lake tomorrow and back up here Monday, Redstone Cinema, and Saturday at the Temple Theater in Park City at Saturday night then.
So beam yourself to one of those screenings.
Beam us over, Scotty. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Wait, Don't Tell Me is more than a fun look at the week's news. We also provide you with the latest developments in medicine and beer.
Bud does sound like the noise that people tend to make when they're having a heart attack.
Yeah, but.
Wait, the news quiz from NPR. It might just save your life.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
Hi, this is Squid from Jans, a longtime KPCW supporter. Jans offers a ski test program where you can try them before you buy them, plus guaranteed custom boot fitting and World Cup level ski tunes at Rensdell. Jans provides services for skiers at 8 Park City locations, and our phone number is 649-4949.
Back with Sundance in the Morning, and with the co-directors of Web Junkie, which is in the World Cinema documentary. So you do get a chance to vote on this. So remember to vote on this. And it's Ila Medalia, or is that
Ila Medalia?
Medalia, okay. And Shosh Shlam. Welcome.
Thank you. And your
first screening isn't until
tomorrow
at the Yarrow 6 o'clock, but somehow with his magical co-host powers, David Darcy has seen the picture already.
That is correct. And, you know, this picture addresses a number of things, but the two things that I think are most important is, first of all, the pathology of one's relationship to technology. And then even in a country like China, where the family is the strongest institution and the institution that most Chinese have more respect for than their government, technology can erode these family bonds to the point where families are sending their children to a boot camp to address the what's diagnosed as an addiction and as an addiction to the internet. How did two Israelis end up in China making this film?
I saw one day an item on the Australian television saying that one of the boys was beaten to death in one of those boot camps. And when I thought that I want to deal with this subject, I thought that the best thing to do is to go to China when this phenomena is so extreme. So I went to China to look for this boot camp that I knew that it's in south of Beijing. And in the first time, I didn't succeed to find the connection. I went home, but I had a strong desire to do it. And I went back to China, and I found connection to this professor that established this boot camp. It was the first one in the world to treat, children with the internet addiction after China declared it.
Yeah. Now, that was Shosh Shlom from the film Web Junkie. The Chinese have their own reasons for cooperating or not cooperating with journalists, with movies. What was the Chinese interest in having you make this film, or at least allowing you to make the film?
Actually, we didn't have government permission. We didn't even try to get one because the camps are on military bases, so it's not likely to get, since we're Westerners, to get this permit. Once we met with Professor Tao, and he basically gave us the access and he invited us, he's very proud of what he's doing. He feels like a revolutionary in the field, and he wanted everybody to know about his research and what he's doing.
Now, why would this diagnosis first happen? I mean, in common parlance, you hear this all the time. He's addicted to this. He's addicted to that. But why the official diagnosis, and why China? Why did this happen in China?
I think that China, as a communist party, needs to be in control of their citizens. And we are talking about huge numbers of 24 million of teenagers that are addicted. So for them, I mean, to control it is to declare it. And we know that in the West, I mean, it's not in the DSM yet, but it's a big embarrassment for the psychiatrist community, how to declare it, because in any other addiction, you can take it away. And here, you cannot take it away because the computer became a part of our life.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, after China, one of the countries that I think is most hooked into the computer is Israel. So,
yes,
you're coming from a perspective of knowledge of something
yes.
like this.
Actually, one of there was a research in Israel or in Europe actually that checked the amount of use among young adults in Europe, and Israel was one of the countries that they checked, and actually Israel was number one in the amount of hours that the youth spend online.
Well, how do they define addiction? Because I think there's a lot of us, once we learn how to use the computer, you can sort of waste a lot of your life. Instead of doing actual work, you can say, Let me look up Ela, see what else she's done. Let me look up her IMDb profile, and we can, spend half the day looking up this and looking up that. But I guess that is that a ditching, or this is something a lot more hardcore?
I think that an addiction in China, they said if you spend more than 6 hours, not for study or work, you are an addict. But when you stop functioning in your own life and you are spending day and nights in an internet cafe, so what would you call it? Mm-hmm. And I mean, the escape of the children, there is a cause to it. And in China, it's because one child policy and a very strict education system. So these are the two main causes in China.
Yeah, one of the sentiment that you get, that you observe here, is extreme loneliness on the part of a lot of these kids. And, you know, it's funny, and the paradox is, of course, the internet is supposed to be bringing like-minded people together. They're often, and if they're not at home, they might be in rooms together where they're all on the internet. But this paradox of loneliness in a place where people are rounded up, but each is focused on a screen instead of each other. And also the family, one would think that given if there's only one child, there'd be a huge amount of attention paid to that one child. But as we find all the time, both parents are so busy providing for that child that there's no time to spend with the child, and you either throw money at the child or throw a device at the child like the internet, and of course, you know, it doesn't work out.
And also there is a lot of stress or a lot of pressure on these kids because they're only one child. They need to provide for their parents and for their grandparents, so the parents puts a lot of pressure on the kids.
But yes. But also in America, what I read, a research that a father is spending half an hour with his children during a week.
Oh, it's in the United States. It's terrible. It's terrible. And you have – oh, it's – and then with commuting time and all that, the long hours that people work, it's a – We see this. I mean, there's no question that this is happening in the United States. But what's also interesting in the United States, it's happening with wealthy families and it's happening in immigrant families where you would think that the family would be the closest unit. But it's, you know, the parents are working so hard that they can either give – they don't have time, so they can give money or things to their kids. But, you know, you could say and there's an addiction to television. Most people, or a lot of people, spend more than 6 hours a day watching it. And of course, like any addict, there are excuses that are made. I'm not watching television. I'm watching the Independent Film Channel. This is all really wholesome stuff that I'm watching. It's not trash. This is serious, life-affirming movies, the kind of things that premiered at Sundance.
Yeah, I'm not wasting time on Google. I'm doing important research here.
So who funded this film? Was this funded by an Israeli film agency?
Yes.
It's
a documentary channel in Israel and the new foundation for the Israel New Foundation for Film and Television. And the American partners are Chicken and Egg, Impact Partners, Gucci Tribeca, and
The New York State Council of the Arts also gave, because I'm based also in New York.
Right. And you got some of the few dollars that are remaining at the New York State Council of the Arts. Right. We know about that. What was it like being Israeli working in China, even though you didn't go through? I have to say, I was in China as a journalist, and I chose not to go through official channels, and I was literally running away from police in a town that I will not identify. But it's tough doing information gathering when you don't have official permission if they find out that you're there.
I think that, first of all, the biggest challenge as far as working in China was the cultural gap, the cultural difference.
Does either of you speak Chinese?
No.
So you hire translators?
Yes, translators. But
so you had there are intimate scenes of interviews with these kids. So all this was translated. There's a translator there all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
It's a tribute to the editing of the film that this really you know, seems so natural.
And yeah. And I think also at times we couldn't get the translation right when it happened because you couldn't disturb the situation. So after it happened, and also the style of the way the film was shot, the varieté style, sometimes you don't interrupt the situation anyway as they're happening.
And maybe can you give us a little sneak preview, a little overview of the three? It was three teenagers that you dealt with, and a little bit about just who they are and what they're like.
There are three teenagers that we found there. One is Nikki, as you saw in the film. The relationship in the family is very difficult. A lot of violence. He tried to commit suicide a few times. Also, during his staying in the camp. The next boy is Hope. He's now in the United States with his mother because his parents got divorced. Also, you know, very bad relationship with his father, you know, disappearing for nights to the internet cafe.
Let me interrupt you for a second because we're running out of time. Two things struck me about this. In the United States, if a comparable group of kids would be obese. These kids, China hasn't faced that problem with these kids yet. And the other thing is that it's all boys.
It's mostly boys.
And we know from looking at social media that if you want to extend the internet or electronic media addiction, that girls as well as boys are locked into this in most countries.
Well, most of these kids are playing games, actually the same games that are also in the United States, like World of Warcraft.
It's a strategic game, you know, so boys are getting more connected, I think.
Okay. Well, in the world of Sundance, like we said, your first screening, you'll meet an audience tomorrow at the Yarrow. And in this area, next time is Tuesday at the Redstone Cinema out there in the Park City outskirts, Thursday at the Holiday Village Cinema, and a week from today, Saturday, at the Temple Theater. Again, what is this deal about? They're putting Israeli filmmakers at the Temple. I wonder if
I'm not going to say that it's a Jewish conspiracy, but I'll let my Israeli friends decide what accounts for that.
Okay. Ilah Medalia and Shosh Slam, thank you very much for taking your time here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming.
This is Earl with Nexus IT. Nexus IT is proud to sponsor KPCW. Nexus IT provides hosted PBX and voiceover IP phone services, systems, and repair. Our phone number is 435-487-9099 and on the web at nexusitc.net.
And we're back for our final segment for Sundance in the morning, and we have a guest on the phone here, Sheila Nevins from HBO, and it's probably somebody. Sheila, good morning.
Yes, I'm here. I promise.
Hi, Sheila. It's David Darcy.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. So, why are you not at Sundance this year? You were a stalwart. How many years were you coming? More than 20?
17. I took off a year. Give me a break.
Okay, we'll let you off easy on this one, but
I let the films do the walking and my great staff do the talking.
Okay, there's one film that I saw ahead of time, captivated, the Pamela Smart story.
Right.
Fantastic story, a great reflection on the nature of the media, the facts of the Pamela Smart case, a young woman who was convicted of conspiring to kill her husband with some high school kids, but the facts come into question, the legitimacy of the conviction and the imprisonment come into question, and the media comes into question. And it's also very stylish, really cinematic. Tell us a bit about how that project started, because it's very hard to get access to a prisoner in a maximum security prison.
Well, we started working on it early with a very small development deal, and Jeremiah is just a great filmmaker, and access to Pam Smart. And then somehow we felt, being the media ourselves, making the film, we were implicated also. And the best we could do was let so that we could take a look at what media does. I mean, the outrageousness of this trial, as we learned more and more about it, was, number one, the jury was sequestered. During their voir dire, they said they knew nothing about the case. And one of the jurors kept a record of each of the testimonies in each of the days. And that began to be the foundation for looking into this really interesting film about, which implicates all of us. And also the injustices of the difference between what a man gets and what a woman gets. Pam Smart got life without parole from a judge who wanted to be in the movies. He clearly said he wanted Clint Eastwood to play his part. Any judge who says that, as far as I'm concerned, should not be judging a case. A jury that's not sequestered in a trial, which I knew about, in New York, something that was happening in New Hampshire. I mean, give me a break. How did anybody in New Hampshire not know about what was going on? So I think Pamela Smart, whatever she did, was guilty from the get-go. And the media gave the get-go. And I think, it's just an interesting film to show at a film festival, especially film festival like Sundance, because we're in it together, We took the incident and we made it a movie.
Yeah, how long did it take to make this film? Because this is really a film with an enormous amount of...
Jeremiah, I don't know the answer to that. I think a couple of years.
Yeah.
Every good docu is the labor of love and time, and you suddenly look up and you're older, and your kids are, go from junior high to high school, or are married by then.
Yeah.
When you put your nose in a docu and you wake up from the end, and you finally see the credits, you've moved on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this must have been a passion for a very long time.
Yeah. Sheila, what can you tell us about the growth of the audience for docs on HBO? Has there been, because we were talking earlier in the show about the difficulty of theatrically reduced released docs, of finding an audience, even if the critics are overwhelmingly behind those docs. Has the audience for docs on HBO grown over the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, getting an audience for docs is tough. It's always tough, because the star is usually an anonymous person. Making anonymity rival stars in cinema is a very difficult thing to do. And yet, through the anonymous person, you really find yourself. So it's very, very difficult to get an audience. How do we get an audience on HBO? Well, first of all, we repeat a lot. Crime and sex, of course, does better than, food stamps and, lunch for kids. So, you're always going to have a problem getting people to watch. But television, in many ways, is a great medium for it, because by accident, people land on you. It's like your airport is there. So if it's a bad day outside, they just might watch that docu. And then there is, of course, a core built-in documentary fan in your audience. But they're consistent, and I don't think they've changed over the years.
Sheila, this is Rick with KPCW. Now, does HBO have some other documentaries here, or is Pamela Smart the one?
No. We're very proud of our docus there. We have Love Child. We have a film about domestic violence. our star film, the one we're most anxious about, is on today at noon. It's Prop 8. It's the fight to defeat Prop 8. A film made by Ben Kottner and Ryan White. It's a wonderful, wonderful film, edited exquisitely. And it's really about guys fighting back. And by guys, I mean little guys, all guys, not just gay guys, but us as a guy, me as a guy. Yeah. But the system listens if you organize. And I think the message of the film is really quite extraordinary in terms of evolving change. We have our fingers crossed, because we really believe that the film stands for more than just the defeat of Prop 8. It stands for moving forward in a very complicated government structure, because this goes all the way to the Supreme Court from the plaintiff.
Yeah. What does exposure at Sundance mean in terms of, I mean, you're getting these films out. Does it make any particular difference if Prop 8 is in a documentary competition, or if it's a premiere, or if they call it a special program? Does that make a difference in terms of the exposure you want to get for the film?
Yes, because Sundance is the premier festival. It's the festival where narrative and docu go hand in hand in terms of competitiveness, similar categories and similar audiences. I mean, docu audiences are packed. When I first went to Sundance and I saw people standing around the block to see a docu, I thought, hey, man, I'm coming back here. I think what Sundance does is it kicks off the docu for you. It begins to have a buzz from Sundance, hopefully, that lives into its other broadcast entities, and I think that makes a great difference for a docu. I mean, we wouldn't be spending so much on schlepping to Sundance if it wasn't for the fact that it's the best place to start a docu. Best place, you know, high up, you breathe the air, and you know you made it. You're on your way to making it. In terms of visibility, you're never going to make a lot of money. You're never going to, you know, it's just a great place to be recognized for your message. Sundance is about message, and message is what docus are. And, you know, where else are you going to, you need a noisy place to kick off a message. People are tired of listening to messages. So Sundance is the best place to go.
Okay, what is it? Is it an opportune moment that the case against it, the film on Prop 8, is premiering at Sundance at a time when there's a huge battle over gay marriage in the state of Utah? Did you have anything to do with creating this moment?
I have a doll with pins on it, and it has all the states in the United States. And late at night one night, all of us got it together, Kate Amend, the great editor, and my colleague Lisa Heller, and Ben and Ryan, and we stuck pins in the state of Utah, and that's how it happened. You see?
I knew there was a special story. Now, I should tell you, there's going at 3 o'clock at the Wazo, there's a party for this film,
yes.
And hundreds, at least 100 couples are going to come
in their wedding
clothes.
What?
Yeah, they're going to come in their wedding clothes to this party.
Yes, of course. Why else would they come? Why else would they? Could you ever hear of a photo op?
Well, of course I've heard of a photo op. I'm going to be there taking pictures.
Oh, great. You see? We caught you.
But I think this is a moment that no one ever expected. We thought that Park City was the place that was cauterized and isolated from the rest of Utah, but it's spreading out all over Utah. This is the dread that a lot...
Wait, we move the festival outside of Park City after this experience. Look, we have a message, and it's our job to get the message out.
Okay.
And if it takes 100 couples and you and your camera... That's okay with us.
Thanks, Sheila.
And Sheila, getting the message out with the case against 8, it premieres in Park City today at noon at the Temple Theater.
Yes.
And Trials of Pamela Smart, next showing in this area is Sunday at the Redstone Cinema. And Sheila,
Love
we hope...
There's Child and there's Private Violence. We have, you know, other films there.
Right. And
we want you to see them all.
Yeah.
We want you to get the message.
Okay, and we hope to get you next year in the flesh.
Yeah. I promise I'll bring my flesh. There's a lot of it. I'll be there.
Thanks a lot, Sheila. Bye
Take
now.
Take care. Best, David.
Okay,
Take care. Bye-bye.
And that's it for Sundance in the Morning. Thanks to co-host David Darcy, and I'll see you around town and hopefully next year.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick. Bye now.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me for The Splendid Table, an hour of lively and informative conversation and your calls about the first love in just about everyone's life, food. From in-depth looks at America's food chain to conversations with cheesemakers in the hills of Sicily, food is a doorway to great adventure. So join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by River Horse on Main.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
All right, and that wraps up our Sundance broadcast for this morning, but we have more coming up today. Today from 1 to 4 o'clock, we're going to simulcast KCRW's, LA's public radio station, with Ann Litt and Jason Bentley. We're going to broadcast them live from the Acura booth there on Main Street. So give us stay tuned in all day. Plus, we'll have traffic, weather, all the things that you need, because only here in Park City and only on KPCW can you get that kind of stuff. This is 91.9 FM KPCW Park City in the Heber Valley, 88.1 FM in Camas and Colville, and online at kpcw.org. We've got NPR News coming up in just a few seconds. 29 degrees outside. This is KPCW.